Because adversity is often the breeding ground for development. Dive into neurointerventional stories, the uncensored interviews. Our guests, all leaders in the field of neurointervention, share the difficulties they face, the complications they have had to manage, and speak without filters on little discussed, sometimes controversial, or simply taboo subjects. Hello, my name is Dantia Sujichantararat, and today I am pleased to welcome Dr. Staff Jimakaris. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
So obviously everyone in the field knows you. You're a big force in the field. But if you can introduce yourself in a few words and your path to get here.
Thank you. I'm humbled. You're too kind. I come from the neurosurgery pathway. I am a dual trained cerebrovascular and endovascular neurosurgeon. I completed my entire training at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. And I am very excited about both cerebrovascular and endovascular. I'm excited about women in the field. I'm one of the first women to be trained in doing this dual trait. And I'm very excited about organized neurosurgery.
Prior to coming here, I had the opportunity to, actually Dr. Arthur came to Yale not too long ago, and he offered to look over my interview list. And so he looked over the interview list, and he gave kind of like a point by point for every interviewees, and he spoke very, very highly of you.
Full disclosure, he and I are good buddies.
Well, still. It is a little bit tough to kind of pick one thing to talk about, so why don't we start with kind of a bigger theme, since this is a series that's focusing on the uncensored interviews, the complications, and the difficulties. I start everyone by asking, what has been the biggest professional difficulties that you have had to encounter to date?
I think one of the difficulties is to find the proper mentors. Mm-hmm. And as a young attending, both as an interventionalist as a neurosurgeon, you want to find early on in your careers mentors that you can emulate, that they will guide you. And I know you mentioned Adam Arthur. He's one of them for me. Mm-hmm. But it's really important when it comes to not only clinical advice, because it's not uncommon even at this stage for us to share cases and get each other's opinion, but also academically to have the support to build a network and to be able to make a difference in a more systemic and a more national and, as you see today at the Link, international way.
Was there any case or any complications that you can think about early in your career that have shaped your career today or have an impact on your career today?
Yeah, I think more than a specific case, complications are very important, both as an operator, but most importantly, in reviewing and learning from them. I know there's a lot of venues, Adnan, Siddiqui, and colleagues. We have the 3C, the Cerebrovascular Complications mm-hmm. Conference, a dedicated mm-hmm. conference, that we humbly present complications, and these can't be great saves. Mm-hmm. These have to be complications that are unfortunately devastating or really impairing patients, because unfortunately that's the way to learn from them what happens when things go wrong. I was excited to see at the Link that there's a similar venue and was charged with the tough presentation of the complications lecture. But I really think as a young attending, they can be not only humbling, but oftentimes discouraging, especially if you have some complications early in your career. You need to remind yourself that no matter what you do, there's always a risk of complication. You need to be open with the patients and the families and have really healthy discussions, two-way discussions with the possibilities of a complication. But most importantly is to review these complications. I know internally, most academic, even large private practice institutions have systemic morbidity and mortality conferences, the point of which is to learn mm-hmm. from them. I think we need to do a better job in organized endovascular, cerebrovascular, neurological conferences to systemically report these complications mm-hmm. and to actually have a healthy discussion, mm-hmm. especially with our young trainees, how to avoid them, what's your bailout option. Mm-hmm. And I think regardless of the stage of your career, you're going to learn a lot from that.
So I have two follow-up questions on that. The one that I think you're a perfect person to speak on is that I know you are a fellowship director. You have a big role in education. You're gearing up to be a chair-elect of the CV section. How do you see the change in fellowship training and in teaching complication management to the fellows? How do you think we could do better?
Great point. I think one of the very hot topics today is simulation. And simulation should happen throughout one's training and actually even post-training. We have great tools. We have companies with incredible devices where you can actually recreate an aneurysm model, an AVM model, and take any steps, check your catheters. We need to utilize simulation a lot more, especially before challenging cases. And we need to also utilize senior practitioners' expertise. Mm-hmm. For example, it could be your own institution. If you're starting your career and you have mid-level or senior partners, please, I know sometimes it's frowned upon to ask for advice, especially when you're starting. You know, are you not confident enough as a surgeon? It's the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. I really think very highly of somebody who's humble enough to discuss a case, even at a more senior level. So we need to have more mentoring and we need to have proctoring, even internally within your own institution, to really gain from years and decades long of experience from other operators.
Do you think then, when I interviewed Dr. Montalverne, he strongly suggested as a young practitioner coming out, you really shouldn't be anywhere where you're by yourself. Would you sort of agree with that sentiment?
Interestingly, yeah. It's a great concept. I think if you interpret this comment as you shouldn't start a solo practice mm-hmm. without any supervision or without anybody to bounce off ideas. But oftentimes, you know, life takes you places. If you are in a solo practice, you don't have the luxury of a larger practice or an academic institution, please maintain your network, mm-hmm. whether that's your alma mater, the place you trained at, whether that's connections and networking throughout your early career, or whether these are physicians that you admire and you emulate. You'll see a lot of us are very easy to approach. You can send an email, you can show interest. Mm-hmm. A bunch of us with some of our graduating fellows at Jefferson, we actually have a WhatsApp group and we nice. Bounce off interesting cases, obviously de-identified, but we will throw a case there and everybody pitches in and it's incredible the kind of advice and experience you get from something like that.
That's awesome. And then the second question out of the first thing that you said was that, you know, in terms of complication reporting, obviously our field is very technologically driven field. It's got a lot of industry dollars, very important to the advancement of all the tools that we have. How do you balance the need from that side of things to have good outcome versus honest reporting, which is what's good for the patient?
I think going earlier to, I know you said you spoke with Ricardo, but I really think we need to be better at reporting. We need to stop worrying about implications and medical legal concerns and just honest reporting of these complications in a more systemic fashion will give you a venue to not only collect the data, but to actually analyze. For example, you see AI and robotics are now becoming mainstay, and I'm hoping within the next 5-10 years mm-hmm. will be incorporated in our practice. With these models, you can have automated, computer-generated responses to microcatheter movements, earlier detection in a superhuman level of potential impending complication, just by collecting and analyzing systemically all these hundreds of thousands of data that potentially you could collect nationally or internationally. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be the best way to not only improve technologically, improve our patients' lives and function, but also to advance the field. Mm-hmm. Because we shouldn't fight AI and robotics. We should embrace it and we should allow it to make us better mm-hmm. through computer-generated algorithms.
We're going to shift gear a little bit and talk about some of the personal difficulties that you've had to overcome. And we can take this anywhere you want. What was the first thing that came to your mind in terms of personal difficulty pursuing this career?
I think a lot of us that we start younger in our careers, the concern is how to balance. Actually, my Villanova MBA professors would correct me to integrate, not balance. But how do you integrate your family and building your family if you're young with a robust clinical and academic career? And that's one of the earlier challenges that I think you will face when you enter the field. And my answer to that, from my experience, is to have tremendous family support, to be humble, asking for help, whether that's at home, whether that's at work, to accept that you're not going to be the best at everything, and to really be very careful in selecting your life partner. Cannot overemphasize how at the end of a challenging day or, you know, saying I'll be home at 6 o'clock for dinner and 10 o'clock rolls around, I still haven't left, how having that supportive spouse at home can really make a world of difference. So I think that's one of the earlier struggles you may face. As a practitioner, I think, going back to complications, you really want to build that confidence. So you preferably want to be at a place where it's the volume is there. So clinically, you're going to get experience by doing 100 of a difficult case to 100 of those. And again, being in a very collegial, healthy environment, where just having somebody lay eyes on you during a tough case earlier on in the career, having those mentorships both locally and nationally is of paramount importance.
So we are nearing the end of the podcast, so I'm going to ask you 4 questions that we asked everybody.
Okay.
So the first one is, if we go back 10, 15 years, was there anything that you would do differently, anything you would tweak?
I would invest in pipeline. I think going back 10 to 15 years ago, I was starting my practice. I would just encourage myself to just be me, to stay strong. And one thing I would recommend to my younger self would be to early on build those networks. Mm. I wish I attended Link several decades and years ago. Because you just build these lifelong connections with colleagues from all across the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that expands not just your clinical decision making, but also your view on life. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible what you can accomplish as a whole, as a team. So,
yeah. Someone asked me how I ended up being here and interviewing you guys. And honestly, I just said yes to anything. They asked me if I want to do it. And it's been like the greatest yes I've ever said, because getting to talk to people like you guys has been
okay. I'm
going to
give you some advice,
okay?
Because I'm known to say yes to everything, and my executive coach suggests that for every yes I say, now I have to start balancing with a no.
Oh goodness!
So just be very careful and be a little more selective, especially the more senior you get. I think earlier in your career, you don't want to turn down a lot of opportunity.
Right.
But as you go mid to senior level career, you need to start balancing those yeses with the noes, because you just don't want to fully overwhelm yourself. And you want to have outlets of renewal, definitely within your home and your family, but also when it comes to renewing yourself through activities, through sports, through hanging out with friends. So you got to try to find that balance. So a little note on that, on always yes.
Fair. Thank you very much. And if we fast forward 15 to 20 years, where do you think our field will be?
That's a great question. I'm hoping, we actually just attended, Adam Arthur and AJ Wakalu did a tremendous job setting up the first inaugural ARISE meeting. And that was a meeting where you have merging of everybody involved in cerebrovascular and endovascular care. And those included FDA, NIH, industry, and cerebrovascular experts. And we are actually coming up with a consensus in different parts of hemorrhagic cerebrovascular disease, aneurysms, AVMs, subdural hematomas, consensus on management, consensus on where does the future lead us. And I think the discussion was that ultimately we should merge all those thoughts and ideas, not just at a national level, but an international level. For example, why not have CE and FDA collaborate? So were discussing about managing aneurysms and AVMs, and overall, especially AVMs, the incidence is so low. Right. So to collect enough data in terms of natural history, in terms of rupture, you need really thousands of patients and a lot of patient years, and those studies may not become feasible anymore. Mm-hmm. If you have multinational and international data collection and collaboration of these federal agencies, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that's part of our future. Mm-hmm. We can have tremendous enrollment, tremendous level one evidence data for a lot of what we do. I think another component of future care will be real life feedback, artificial intelligence, simulation, robotics, all that in one big continuous practice from the minute you meet the patient to the minute post-operative care. I think that's going to be mainstay of our treatment.
I'd be interested to see 15, 20 years from now, looking back on these interviews. I'm curious, I'm just digressing a little bit. I'm curious, as a dual trained person, how do you see the open component fitting into all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm also, I know Mike Lawton and a lot of open giants in the field, Jacques Marcos, I agree with them that there's absolutely going to be a need for open surgery. I'm hoping that we're going to start to see a lot of hybrid surgery, both endovascular and open cerebrovascular. But there's always going to be a need for open microsurgical approaches for bailout in terms of complications of endovascular. So I think open, it's here to stay. Most importantly, I think, though, training the new generation the other way around, mm-hmm. I think, is very challenging. You cannot practice, I would think, in 10, 15 years, cerebrovascular surgery without having that endovascular piece. So I think it's going to be a service to your patients, to you and your career, to your decision-making, to have both tools if you're going to be performing those kind of surgeries.
And actually, our third question you sort of already answered, which is, you know, what do you think we're not doing enough for the young practitioners today? So we talked about simulation. So I'm going to skip to the last question. We're going to end on a more positive note. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about any initiative, any person, any technological advancement that you can think of in the recent months or even years that you think have been the highlight of our field.
I am very excited about OCT. Uh-huh. I was in awe at Arise. Matt Gunas presented his tremendous data. Mm-hmm. And Vitor today left us with a cliffhanger with utilizing OCT post flow diversion deployment, mm-hmm. to be able to assess wall opposition and the need of angioplasty, etc. I'm hoping that OCT will become part of our endovascular treatment armamentarium, mm-hmm. because even as a good CTA doesn't have enough, like a Dyna CTA intraoperative doesn't have enough quality resolution to be able to assess these fine details. My hope that this will be incorporated in diagnostics. Mm. So instead of guessing, really, that if you have an irregular aneurysm, most likely the wall is thin. I know in open surgery we see that. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon to actually have such thin walls that you can see the blood swirling in. Mm. In endovascular, that's a little more challenging. Wouldn't it be great if we utilized OCT during diagnostic angiography, mm. and provide the patient with high quality data, mm-hmm. scientific data, that this is a very concerning aneurysm. This is only 3 millimeters,
right?
But we only have a very limited micrometer wall.
Right.
Therefore, you're at high risk of rupture. That would be amazing.
Wow, that's great. Well, thank you very much, mm-hmm. Dr. Chimakaris, for answering our questions today.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to seeing your future and your career in the field.
Me too. Let's see where it goes.